In the early 1960s, Dallas, Texas was brewing with political passions, a city crammed with larger-than-life characters dead set against the Kennedy presidency. Bill Minutaglio and Stephen Davis now provide an account of the city that would become infamous for the assassination of a president of the United States. In their new history, Dallas 1963, they explored the city in the years leading up to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and they describe an angry place, a stew of super patriotism fueled by anti-communist paranoia, fierce racism, and anti-Semitism. Minutaglio joins us on the roundtable this morning to discuss the civic hysteria that kept Dallas churning until Kennedy's death and the infamy that continues to dog it decades later. Bill Minutaglio, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
In looking at this story and deciding to begin where you begin, which is in 1960, what brought you to that time, to that beginning point? Because I assume you basically have to work backwards, right?
Yep, that's a great question, a good observation. 1960, to me, is the height of irony as it relates to President Kennedy. It was, as it particularly relates to Dallas as well, it was obviously the year that he went to the White House, but our argument was that you need to build to a moment, a particular moment in November of 1960. It was the closest presidential race that year up to that point in American history. Kennedy was deadlocked with Nixon, and as the summer went on and into the fall, a decision was made by Bobby Kennedy, who was helping to manage his brother's campaign, that we needed to get LBJ down to Texas to, at the very minimum, secure the state of Texas for the Kennedy-LBJ ticket. Bobby Kennedy used some more colorful language about it all. He said, you know, we really need to get that SOB down there. That's the reason he's on the ticket, to lock up the state of Texas. We can't believe we might lose that state. So as time went on, a decision was made just 4 days before the November election, let's send LBJ down to Dallas particularly. He'll do some last-minute politicking and campaigning on home turf, hopefully lock up that state. And what happened that day, 4 days before the election, the closest one then, again, in American history, was it the Kennedy-LBJ ticket was assailed in a really physical way. LBJ showed up with Lady Bird Johnson, his wife, to give a speech, and as they stepped out of their limousine in downtown Dallas, they found themselves facing what's now been called the mink coat mob. It was about 300 of the better-dressed and really thoroughbred folks in the city, folks who normally wouldn't behave in the way that they began behaving. They accosted and assailed LBJ and Lady Bird, yelling at them, spitting at them, pulling out hat pins out of their hats, trying to stab people. It was a melee. It was a riot. And several people had to be taken to the hospital. They were accusing LBJ and Kennedy of being socialists, of traitors, being on bended knee to the Russian bear, that the United States would be annihilated by a nuclear attack. And it was rather staggering, especially for Lady Bird Johnson. She was looking around, in essence, seeing decorum erode before her eyes. One of the reasons it was called a mink coat mob, by the way, is many of the folks happened to be women who were wearing mink coats, some of which they had bought from nearby famous store Neiman Marcus in Dallas. The irony, the reason I'm building to a point here, is that cameras were rolling. It was the modern media age, or the beginning of it, in a sense, on television. And later that evening, folks around the nation saw that these folks, seemingly normal folks in Dallas, were behaving in this irrational and violent way, and began, as they were consuming and seeing those images out of Dallas, began thinking that they would vote in sympathy with the Kennedy-LBJ ticket. So the irony to me, the cruel irony, is that some historians have said that that incident actually helped propel Kennedy to the White House and Johnson, that it folks saw what had happened in Dallas and voted in sympathy for them, and that the cruel irony, of course, comes in November of 1963, that the Kennedy White House ended in Dallas, in a sense, several years later. It began in Dallas and ended in Dallas.
And as you make the point, these are not people who are outside of the mainstream. You're talking about many of the main rich and powerful characters of Dallas, Texas, who are part of this movement who have a great say in what's happening in the city and even the state.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Another good observation. And I'd like to underscore, you know, something that Dallas, I lived in Dallas for many years. I worked for 20 years at the Dallas Morning News, and I suppose I have a bias toward liking Dallas for that reason. Many of my best friends are still there. I now live in Austin, Texas, but I have great affection for the city. And I'd really like to underscore that I think what happened in Dallas is very cautionary, that a handful of folks who happened to be a little more powerful, they had a little more money and influence in business climates and religious climates, even within the media, that they, in a sense, stole the microphone. They hijacked it. And were really not speaking for the majority. They simply were not. There were thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of folks in Dallas who either loved Kennedy or, at the minimum, respected the office to not behave in the way that a very distinct minority did. So to me, it's almost a civic lesson of how a handful of folks who have the sort of the muscled up will and, you know, frankly, the wherewithal, the money, the resources, and then the sphere of influence through the pulpit, through churches, and even through control of the media can almost redirect the entire dialogue and then even suggest that they are the majority or are speaking on behalf of the entire city. And again, what happened was, just as one example, you had the world's richest man, oil billionaire H.L. Hunt, happened to be living in Dallas. He happened to thoroughly dislike Kennedy. He thought Kennedy was a socialist and was going to drive the country into ruin. Hunt was an amazing figure. He began spending millions and millions of his own dollars to create extremist radio broadcasts in Dallas, emanating out of Dallas. They were reaching about 10 million listeners a day, suggesting that, you know, Kennedy administration would be the ruin of us all, that America would cease to exist. Hunt had a backup plan, by the way, that if America was assailed, he was going to help rewrite the Constitution. And in fact, he did. He proposed a new Constitution for the United States in which folks who made above a certain amount of money would be allowed to vote more often than other folks. He believed, as an example, that as a billionaire, he was entitled to 7 votes, and that if you had enough money, you could purchase more votes. So he had some rather radical ideas about things, but he, you know, was funding the anti-Kennedy movement there, and again, creating the sense, I think, from the outside looking in, that Dallas was just the most singular place in America. It actually was, but only because of this very distinct group of people, a dozen or so folks who were so powerful and sort of had the access to the image of Dallas that they could re-sculpt it.
And as you point out throughout the book, that much of the fuel for this anger comes from the concerns over segregation.
Oh, that's the backstory, and not distinct, you know, in Dallas, right, to other cities. I grew up in New York City, and I could tell you it was just as bubbling and gurgling an event there, of course, as it was. That's stating the obvious. But in Dallas, there was something interesting going on. Dallas, a lot of folks don't know this, was the last major American city to integrate its public schools. And I think some folks would say, well, that must have occurred in some other deep southern place opposed to a more western kind of city like Dallas. But Dallas absolutely had a lid, put a tight, tight lid on integration well after the Brown v. Board of Education decision in the mid-50s, ordering the desegregation of schools. It was just not happening in Dallas. Another illustration of that in some way is the fact that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was not coming to Dallas. Some folks have suggested to me that he was told not to come there, warned not to come there, and that his advisors suggested that's probably a place that wouldn't be very welcoming, to use a word. He finally did come there. It was his first major public appearance in the city in January of 1963. You know, that's obviously the year that President Kennedy came to Dallas. But in January of 63, Dr. King finally came and to address that very issue of integration. And what happened? There was a bomb threat lodged against him. obviously not to fruition, but it was indicative of how, as well, there was this unease and fear also operating in the background in Dallas as it related to the social changes.
We are talking to Bill Minutaglio. He is the author of the new book, along with Stephen Davis, Dallas 1963. It is published by 12. The cover of the book shows a flyer that went around in Dallas in November of 1963. And it was plastered all over the city, you point out, thousands of them. And ultimately, it looks like a wanted poster, and it says wanted for treason, and it has a front-on shot of the president and a side shot of the president. It does look like a wanted poster, which brings up the question of with that being the mood and certainly what you write about for so much of the book, what were the concerns in the administration of bringing the president into this stew, into the situation on November 22nd?
That's another great question. The Kennedys knew that Dallas was singular. They knew it was unique. They had been getting field reports from sympathetic, allies, if you will, Democrats in Texas, saying you really ought to think twice about coming to the city of Dallas. For some reason, that place has become the citadel of the anti-Kennedy movement in America, and that's just unequivocally true. They knew that H.L. Hunt, the world's richest man, had been spending millions of his own dollars directing anti-Kennedy campaigns. They knew that the leader of the largest Baptist congregation in America happened to be headquartered in Dallas, happened to thoroughly distrust President Kennedy. He, along many lines, he thought that Kennedy was pushing too quickly on integration, but this minister as well, again, the leader of the most powerful Baptist congregation in the country, felt that Kennedy was practicing the dark art of Catholicism. There was this sort of Catholic phobia that Kennedy in the White House would probably be on bended knee to a quote, foreign or exotic religion, Roman Catholicism, and it would undermine true Christianity. You had the leader of the most powerful media figure in this part of the country at the time was the publisher of the Dallas Morning News, Ted Dealey, who was thoroughly anti-Kennedy. He had made a point in October of 61 of traveling to the White House to personally confront and accost Kennedy over lunch. He stood up over lunch and began yelling at Kennedy, saying, "You're just like a child. You're nothing more than a little baby. You're just like Carolyn, your daughter, on a tricycle when this country needs a man on horseback." That event made some national headlines at the time, but underscored again this resistance that Kennedy was very personally aware of. He knew that the world's richest man, the most powerful Baptist minister, the most powerful media figure in that part of the country were lined against him. So he knew very well. And by the way, he also knew something else, that media figure, Ted Dealey, for whom his family goes back a long time in Dallas, and Dealey Plaza, famous spot in the assassination pantheon, is named after his dad. But Ted Dealey was so obsessed in his hatred of Kennedy that he began ordering his reporters to investigate rumors that Kennedy had a secret marriage, that he had once been married before, that he had some other secret life. Some of this is alluded to in what you mentioned so articulately, this wanted for treason poster that began circulating. Kennedy knew that was one of the things he might have been wanted for treason for, by the way, having a secret marriage. That Kennedy knew that there was something, in the water, in the air. When he was approaching Dallas on that fateful day, he turned to Jacqueline, of course, his wife, and said, "Get ready, we're headed into nut country, N-U-T, nut country." And I think he was being jocular. I think he knew that the resistance was there, but obviously could never predict the awful apocalyptic, unpredictable thing that occurred. He had certainly a sense and had been warned,
So what would make sense in the story, if it were cut and dried, and of course nothing about this ultimately makes sense, but to prove your argument that if it was this right-wing faction that was responsible for the death of the president, It was not. It was right. at the hands of a man who you believe, Lee Harvey Oswald, mm-hmm. That was a self-described Marxist who yes. defected to the Soviet Union, and then he finds Dallas. It seems to be the opposite. Dallas mm-hmm. seems to be the opposite of ultimately what he is looking for.
At the risk of flattery, again, it's a really good question. It's the anomaly, an avowed leftist Marxist, someone who defected to the Soviet Union. Why would it be he that consensus shows us kill the president? One thing that I would point out is an episode that happened in April of 1963 in which Lee Harvey Oswald attempted to assassinate someone else in Dallas. He had slipped into an alleyway behind a mansion in an affluent part of the city and tried to assassinate a former major general, a man named General Edwin Walker, who had been, in many ways, the titular or out front face of the anti-Kennedy movement in America, probably its most recognized figure. He had been a high-ranking member of the military and essentially was exiled from the military for espousing anti-Kennedy, even anti-Eisenhower, anti-Harry Truman, even anti-Eleanor Roosevelt ideas and literature. He believed that socialism and communism were so deeply embedded in the marrow of American government that we were in deep danger. He was, as I said, essentially exiled from the military. Again, this is a high-ranking guy in charge of a lot of our European presence post-World War II. When he left the military, he became a bit of a cause celeb and a lightning rod figure, maybe that man on horseback for the anti-Kennedy movement. And he decided to move to Dallas, Texas, because it would be the most welcoming environment in America, and there would be these other folks there. Oswald, living in Dallas at the time, and you know, a disturbed individual, tried to assassinate General Walker and came within a whisker of doing it. He fired from an alleyway into the man's house. The bullet grazed Major General Walker's head. And he came out later and he said, this was an assassination attempt. There's someone in this city or forces out there trying to derail super patriots like ourselves. So the point is that Oswald was already moving to his action plan. He had some sort of mission. And my sense of it, and again, I'm certainly not a psychologist, my understanding of him through the great work done by other people, is that he, you know, was a bit of a malleable figure who really wanted to take his place in history, and that I would never say was inspired by events in Dallas, but was certainly influenced by this hothouse, by this the temperature just rising and rising and rising in Dallas. He knew that a bomb threat perhaps had been lodged against King. He tried to assassinate General Walker. In October of 63, the United States ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, had been attacked by another mob in Dallas. He escaped, really with his life. And the same kind of people, the mink coat mob kind of folks that had attacked LBJ and Lady Bird. And here's Oswald, malleable figure, prone to violence anyway. He'd been brutalizing his wife, had already tried to assassinate one person. I think he just said, I need to continue to take my place in history, and perhaps was influenced again by this sense that action must be uncorked, unleashed in this city. And what happened that was fascinating to me, in the immediate wake of the Kennedy assassination, many of these protagonists, I call them protagonists because they seem like they're out of a movie or a novel almost in my book, they either fled the city or began very quickly telling people where they were at the moment Kennedy was assassinated, because they assumed very quickly that they, on the extremist right wing, were going to be blamed for his death. H.L. Hunt promptly went and hid out in New York. Hit out in a hotel in New York. General Walker happened to be on an airplane when the pilot came on the intercom and said, President Kennedy has been killed in Dallas. And what Walker did instantly was go around and ask everybody on the plane for their contact information in case he needed them to bear witness to the fact that he was nowhere near Dallas at the time of the assassination. So there was this sense very quickly that folks who had created this small cabal of people that had created this extremist environment were I don't know if feeling guilty was the right word, but they assumed that they would be blamed. To wit, someone came out to Hunt's house right in the wake of the assassination and began firing a gun at his house, presumably in vengeance in reaction to the president's death.
The name of the book is Dallas 1963. It is published by 12. The book is written by Stephen Davis and Bill Minutaglio. Bill, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the story with us. I appreciate your time.
It's really been great to be with you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Dallas 1963. It's published by 12. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.